From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. 2017 is all about food for us. This year we present a continuing series on Georgia food. It's called Georgia Eats. We'll bring you great conversations with farmers, chefs, cooks, scientists, and even some delicious recipes that you might want to try. This week we kick off our year of Georgia food with two shows focused on stuff we enjoy at the table. Thursday, we'll talk about local beers. Today, we talk about what grows in Georgia. We'll hear about blueberries, pecan truffles, ginger syrup, cowpeas, and beef. But we want you to get involved in this year of food, so tell us what you want to hear about. Farming, brewing, eating, cooking. We want all your Georgia food stories. Call us at 404-500-9457. You could post on Facebook, of course, or reach us on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. If the Southern Organic crowd were made up of teenage fangirls, Mr. Harris would be their Justin Bieber. That's how the New York Times describes our next guest. Will Harris is the owner of White Oak Pastures. It's the largest USDA organic farm in Georgia and the only farm in the country with both beef and poultry slaughterhouses. Will is a fourth-generation cattleman gaining attention for his farm's grass-fed beef and organic operations. When we spoke to Will, we also brought in Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media to talk about whether the trend toward eating organic meat will grow in the future. And I started by asking Grant to explain the difference between organic and grass-fed.
You can have organic grass-fed beef, but it isn't necessarily grass-fed. That's not part of the definition for organic beef. So you can have organic beef that's grain-fed. It's fed feed with organic ingredients. Or you can have organic grass-fed beef, or you can have non-organic grass-fed beef. But more likely than not, someone who's raising animals in a grass-fed way is going to follow organic principles, even if they're not certified.
And what does grass-fed mean? Does that mean they're fed on grass? Does it mean that they're put out to pasture?
It basically means they spend their whole life grazing, whether it's on pasture or in my part of the country, they might spend part of the year on corn stalks during the winter and the grass isn't growing. But they spend their life grazing instead of being sent off to feedlots at a certain point, like the conventional industry.
So, Will, how many cattle do you have?
We usually talk about how many mama cows we have because that's a constant number. We keep about 700 mama cows. The inventory, and your calves are being born and slaughtered all along, so the inventory usually runs anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 head because we keep the calves for almost 2 years.
So help me understand why you made a change. We mentioned you're a fourth-generation cattleman, but your ancestors used chemicals. They did not have grass-fed cattle. Why did you make the change over to both organics and grass-fed beef?
Well, of course, there's been a series of changes. My great-grandfather came here in 1866, actually, and he would have farmed in a manner that was very sustainable, very humane, because that's the way American agriculture was in that era. It was not until my father took over the farm after World War II that he did what the rest of America did. Agriculture during that era centralized, commoditized, industrialized. And that was the big sweeping change. He farmed the farm that way all of his life. I farmed it that way for 20 years of my life. And then we started the journey back to the way my great-grandfather did it, primarily because of the growing dissatisfaction in my mind with industrial methods. I just didn't like it much anymore.
So Grant, one of the reasons that this has been successful for Will is there's a growing grass-fed movement. As I understand it, that the consumption of beef has gone down in recent years, but people are eating more and more organic beef and grass-fed beef. Why is that?
Well, I think you're right. The amount of beef that Americans are eating has been going down in recent years. In fact, it's been going down really since the 1970s. Beef has been on a downward trend ever since then. Most of that has been replaced by chicken or pork. But there's also big growth in organic beef and grass-fed beef. And I think a big part of that does have to do with people understanding more about how the meat is produced and forming their own opinions on what they agree with and what they don't agree with.
And yet, Will, you've been very successful with this. And since Grant mentioned poultry, you added chickens into your cattle ranch. What difference has that made?
It's made a lot of difference. You know, part of the industrialization was the factory farm model, which in my mind means monoculture. You only do one thing on the farm. You know, we believe that nature abhors a monoculture. We strive to emulate nature. Nature wants a lot of different species of plants and animals and microbes living in synergistic lives with each other. You know, look in your garden on the edge of the woods and see what you got. We raise five red meat species: cows, hogs, sheep, goats, rabbits, and five poultry species: chickens, turkeys, geese, guineas, and ducks. And each species benefits the other species in many different ways. We could talk about that all day.
Grant, one of the things that we keep hearing about grass-fed beef is that it's healthier for you. And I wonder if that's true. This must be something that you've looked into, the actual health benefits of a cow or even a chicken that's fed, put out to pasture, as opposed to somebody who's just an animal that's left in the stable or wherever they're kept and fed grain.
Well, yeah, there are some differences. I can talk specifically about the beef. When you compare grass-fed beef to grain-fed beef, you'll see that the grass-fed beef has a lot more omega-3 fatty acids, which people know as a healthy fat that you can consume in your meat. And but in context, it has still far less omega-3s than what we might think of as the big sources of it, something like salmon. You're not going to have as much omega-3 in grass-fed beef as you do in salmon, but you will have more than you have in your grain-fed beef. So definitely in that sense, it's different. It's also leaner than grain-fed beef, and you can look at that a couple different ways. Definitely that's, you know, you're not eating as much fat, so that's one thing. That does hurt grass-fed beef when it comes to USDA grading, because the grading system, people might know prime beef, choice beef, select beef, that puts a big premium on marbling. And those are the flecks of fat that are in that muscle, in that steak, that help it be tender when it's cooked. And so when it's graded, the system sort of doesn't favor grass-fed beef because it's leaner, has less marbling. So it doesn't often reach those same grading levels, but the chefs and people who cook grass-fed beef say that if you do it right, it's just as good.
Well, maybe you can tell me about something which is really unique to your ranch, and that is that, as I understand it, yours is the only one in the nation that has federally approved slaughterhouses for both poultry and cattle. And you brought in the well-known animal scientist Temple Grandin to help you design them. What did Temple contribute, and what is this? I mean, why have the slaughterhouses for both rather than just sending them elsewhere?
Well, as far as why do it, you know, it's an animal welfare issue as well as an environmental issue. From an animal welfare perspective, the animals are not hauled a great distance. You know, my cows walk on pasture all of their lives. You know, to load them on a truck and haul them for even 100 miles, much less 1,000 miles, is a very, very frightening experience for them. You know, they would release adrenaline, which is not in the best interest of the quality of the meat for the animal for a lot of different physiological reasons. From an environmental perspective, we operate these plants as zero waste, which means we take all of the waste, what would be waste products, and turn it into plant food. We compost it to spread it back on the land, and it's just done miraculous things for the productivity of my soil. My soil has gone from less than 0.5% organic matter to over 5% organic matter, and that's the difference in a dead mineral medium than a medium that's just teeming with life. So that as far as Temple Grandin goes, you know, Dr. Grandin is great. She understands things about animal behavior that you and I can only speculate about. you know, for a fee, she designed my plant in a manner that would allow the animals to be dispatched or killed without panicking them. You know, that's very important in terms of the quality of the meat, but also because it's the right thing to do.
Grant, why this resurgence, then, an interest in things like grass-fed beef and organic beef? I mean, you hinted at this a little bit when we were talking about the healthiness of the two types of things, or the differences between the two. But what this kind of is, in a way, is returning to the way it was done 100 years ago.
Well, yeah, definitely that's true. And for the consumers, I think it has a lot to do with, as Will was mentioning, being aware of different production systems. For the farmers and ranchers, a lot of them see it as an opportunity. If they can figure things out, then they can make a pretty good living selling these animals, marketing them directly, and selling them for more than they would otherwise in the sort of commodity system that they are probably part of right now. But it's a huge undertaking if you're going to switch your farm or ranch over to organic production or change to grass-fed beef. If you're going to continue to feed your cows on grass, you're going to need more grass, or you're going to be raising fewer cows.
You're going to need a lot of land.
You're going to need a lot of land, and even grassland, even pasture, is expensive.
Yeah.
And also, you're going to have to figure a lot of things out. Most people don't have a slaughter plant. That means they have to find a meat locker in a small town somewhere that they can take a few animals at a time and have them slaughtered. That's an added expense. And then they have to find a place to sell it. And if you're doing it on your own, then you have to do all that legwork yourself. The meat company isn't taking care of it for you. So that's a ton of work on the front end, and that's something that scares a lot of people away. But for the people that do take those steps, it can pay off.
And since we're talking about it paying off, as I understand, Will, and do correct me if I have these numbers wrong, but you had to borrow millions to make this transition, but your sales last year hit 20, sales, raw sales hit $28
million? That's correct. We built about $7.5 million worth of plants and processing equipment. And over a 10-year period, when we were just selling live cattle, we sold less than $500,000 a year. And last year we sold about $28 million worth of total products. That's not just beef. That's all 10 species of animals. Plus we raise pastured eggs and certified organic vegetables and have some other small ancillary businesses that are part of this whole organism that we call White Oak Pastures. We make biodiesel on our tractors out of the fat. That makes glycerin, so we make soap, which we sell at Whole Foods markets and places like that. And there's, you know, just a lot of. We have a restaurant. We have a lodge cabins for lodging, and you know the other ancillary businesses that grew out of the processing side of our farm.
It's amazing. That is Will Harris. He's a fourth-generation cattleman, owner of White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia. And you just heard about all the different things that White Oak Pastures does. Grant Gerlach also joined us. He's agriculture reporter for Harvest Public Media. Gentlemen, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Celeste.
Thank you, Celeste. Thank you, Grant. Good to be on with y'all.
Coming up, a very Georgia version of gourmet truffles. But first, Oprah finds one of her favorite things in Savannah. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. 2017 is a food year for our team. We're focusing on our state's edibles in a series we call Georgia Eats. And back in 2015, a very special person took notice of one particular Georgia treat.
It's beginning to look a lot like Favorite Things!
The 2015 issue of Oprah's Favorite Things featured an item that's produced right here in Georgia. It's a ginger syrup and ginger-infused honey gift set made by Verdant Kitchen in Savannah. In 2015, CEO Ross Harding joined me to talk about the impact that endorsement had on his business.
We know that we did more business in the last couple of weeks than we did in the first year of our business.
Holy cow! In 2 weeks' time, you did more than in your whole first year of business.
That's correct.
How much time did you get to prepare for that?
Nowhere near enough, because you know that you're going to be, and it's quite a long process, it goes about 4 months, but it really isn't until the last month that you actually know for sure, once that magazine ships.
Oh, so they know, you know they're considering you.
Correct.
And then within a month, they say, okay, you've been chosen.
You've been chosen.
So you have a month to put together hundreds, if not thousands, of gift sets.
Correct. And so it's clearly not enough time.
Okay, so let's talk about what's in this gift set that Oprah likes so much. What do you get when you order this gift box?
So what you get is a lovely box, and inside the box, you're going to get two products. Both of them are based on ginger that's grown here in Georgia. One of them is, I think Oprah described it as a luscious ginger-infused honey. This is one of our greatest products. It's beautiful Georgia wildflower honey that we've infused with ginger. So could you think of anything better for you than that? Have it in tea, drizzle it on fresh apples.
Now, you're taking something which is inherently sweet, which is a honey, mm-hmm. and you're mixing it with something which is inherently bitter and strong tasting. How does that work?
Oh, it's a perfect combination. You know, for really hundreds of years, people preserved ginger by steeping it in cane sugar. This was a really standard way, and the old, you know, the candied ginger that we're used to seeing.
Oh yeah,
and
I
so
eat
actually
it.
This this combo goes really well together. Sweet, a little bit acidic sometimes, and ginger is a fabulous combination.
Can you use it in anything that you'd use honey?
Oh, absolutely. Anything that you'd use honey, you could use this. We've used it in teas. People use it to make beautiful marinades. It's fabulous with some soy on salmon, as you could imagine. It makes a wickedly good candied bacon. So this is a very versatile product. And then the other one is the cocktail syrup.
Cocktail syrup you use just to mix with alcohol?
No, you don't have to, but I would say 80% of the people that buy our product.
Because I would drizzle it over ice cream.
They do. You know, and again, it can be used as a marinade. It can be straight
mix
onto ice cream.
Mix it with yogurt.
It's beautiful in a smoothie. It's really lovely in a smoothie. I love it on fresh pineapple. One of my favorites, and there's a recipe in the product where you take fresh pineapples, banana, and strawberry, drizzle it on this, and grill it for a minute.
You grow in Savannah.
That's correct.
How is Georgia as a ginger-growing location?
So young.
Yeah.
Young. People really haven't grown it here before. I grew up on the east coast of Australia, and I was struck when I went to Savannah. My daughter went to school there, and to SCAD.
Uh-huh.
And I was struck when I went there how similar it was to where I grew up, climate-wise. My business partner owns an old, historic plantation in Savannah. And so about 4 years ago, we said, let's try to grow delicious and healthful products in Georgia.
So how much land does it take to grow the ginger that you need?
Actually, not a lot. It's a very intensive. So, you know, within, you know, less than 20 acres, you can grow a lot of ginger. So
I mean, we're talking about a plant itself, that a root that's not big.
No.
And it's, you don't need a lot of ginger to infuse honey.
No, the flavor is big.
Yeah.
The flavor is big. So you don't need a tremendous amount. What you need is very high quality product.
But we think of ginger as being something that's grown in South Asia and using a lot of South Asian cooking, because we don't often think of the American climate as being conducive to grow ginger. What's the difference in taste, do you think, between a Savannah-grown ginger plant and one that's grown in Thailand?
So we're still experimenting. I mean, we're 4 years into this now as far as growing the product, and we grow 7 or 8 different varieties of ginger, and this has been very much an experiment. What are the different flavors? What are the different tastes? What are the different aromas? What we do know is that some of the gingers here are very strong and they're very citrusy, which is highly prized.
How does this ginger pick up a citrus flavor? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, ginger and its brothers and sisters, turmeric and these other things that we also grow, they're a cornucopia of different flavors and chemicals. And so, you know, it's that complexity. It's like growing grapes. I mean, it's the terroir comes through in these products.
All right. So let's talk about ginger itself as a project. You grow, as you said, turmeric and another sort of related roots. And do you grow other?
No, they're the main ones.
Just those roots. Okay. So let's talk about ginger, because we've seen kind of a resurgence, not just in cooking, but ginger as a healthy thing. Mm. And you said that growing something healthy was your goal.
Correct.
What about ginger made you focus on it as a healthy food?
Yeah, well, I think when we looked at this whole family and we went to build a business, we said, let's make a gourmet and wellness brand. And that might seem an odd combination, but ginger has 4,000 or 5,000 years of history of being great for your circulation, calming. Your grandmother was right when she said, if you've got an upset stomach, have some ginger ale.
Ginger ale, yeah.
Yeah, except now our ginger ale actually has ginger in it, right?
So casting aspersions on Canada Dry, Ross.
I wasn't saying anything about it. It's a fine product.
Yes, because it is, you know, my Jewish grand relatives all the time gave me pieces of ginger to chew on if my tummy was upset.
It really does work. And, you know, we have a lot of people who use it because they travel. People who are on chemo extensively use ginger. It's a very potent anti-nausea product. So there's a lot of things about ginger and turmeric and these other products that have thousands of years of success as health and wellness. And they're delicious.
So tell me about Savannah and Georgia itself as a place to start a brand new business.
Look, particularly to start a business that had to do with agriculture, it was wonderful because I'm not a farmer, nor is my business partner. I'm, in fact, a chemist. You know, and that helped in some ways. But, you know, we went into a venture where we were going to grow on a farm. We were going to grow organically. We were going to grow a product that nobody had grown before. I don't advise this. This is not a good business strategy to follow. And what we did find, though, is that Georgia is full of wonderful support structures. Georgia Organics, a wonderful, wonderful organization. The USDA, strong. The University of Georgia and their agribusiness group. Particularly, let me single out the Georgia Grown campaign led by Commissioner Gary Black and the Department of Agriculture. This is an entire department that's devoted not only to farming, but value added, you know, bringing new products, bringing agritourism to the state. You just had to navigate your way through and find all of these people who are there to help you.
So do you get out on the farm? Do you ever get out there and handle the plants and do any of the actual farming?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do. And I wished I could do it more. I was there actually this week. We were doing some interviews and some filming on the farm, and I just remembered again how wonderful it is. You get your hands in the soil, you see these things grow. It's stressful and worrying, and farming is tough, but it's tremendously satisfying.
Ross Harding of Verdant Kitchen in Savannah. His items made the 2015 issue of Oprah's Favorite Things. We have the full list of all those things posted at our Facebook page. Ross, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much.
Farm-to-table trends are hot all across the country. Chefs and diners from home kitchens to high-end restaurants covet historically regional crops for the future of food. But sometimes it's not so easy to make a Southern staple local again. GPB's Grant Blankenship reports.
Summer vegetables are heaped in stalls at the Mulberry Farmers Market in Macon. And Amanda Chester is looking for purple whole peas.
Oh, man.
Farmer Woody Nix is sold out. You might know the peas Chester is looking for as black-eyed peas. Scientists know them, along with Crowder peas, zipper peas, and others, as cow peas. Chester grew up with them.
Yeah, my grandfather was a sharecropper in Jeffersonville. We raised a plenty.
Cow peas, by any name, help define Southern cuisine.
Oh, they just taste so good.
Cow peas were domesticated in West Africa 5,000 years ago. They came to the Americas with the slave trade. At one time, Georgia alone grew 7 times the cow peas grown in the entire nation today. But now your black-eyed peas probably come from California or maybe even Canada.
Lord knows.
How did that happen?
We got tonight.
As we ride to an experimental field, University of Georgia entomologist David Riley sings the song he wrote about black-eyed peas during some lean times in graduate school.
He just takes them black-eyed peas with a little bit of butter.
This is a massive weevil population, even though it doesn't look like much.
We are looking at a few farm rows. The peas have been picked and the rows are plowed under. Yellow and green weevil traps are parked on about half. This crop is done. It's been given to the weevil known as cowpea curculio.
They said, well, I'm done with it. Let's just mow it and plow it in, get ready for the next season.
Cowpeas can stand up to drought, extreme heat, and terrible soil, but not to this bug. Adult weevils have defeated every pesticide thrown at them.
They're basically like this, like little tanks.
But it turns out the baby weevils, the grubs, do the damage.
Come on, grub.
Donnie Cook, the farmer who tends this plot, digs into a pea pod with his thumbnail.
Thank you, Donnie.
He's wiggly.
He's real wiggly.
The grub looks like a twitchy grain of rice. It left a hole in the pea called a sting by farmers. It makes the pea inedible. After eating the pea, the grub would have dropped to the ground to grow up.
And then about 3 weeks to 4 weeks later, these guys will come back out of the soil.
As adults, ready to make more babies. But until then, the grubs are vulnerable.
They don't have anything to protect them.
Riley says giving up and plowing in gives grubs a free ride to underground safety. He says if you want to save half of your next pea crop, don't plow, but strike.
They do have an insecticide that actually works on the grub. Not on the adult, but it does work on the grub.
Riley thinks that spraying stranded grubs with Lohr's band might improve cowpea yields. But Donnie Cook says it's tough convincing farmers to spray land with no plants for bugs they can't see.
It's a hard sell after they've done got what they're going to get out.
Controlling this weevil could make the difference between cowpeas as a farmer's market specialty and a crop you could rely on again in times of drought and extreme heat. But for David Riley, this is also about legacy.
And I look back at my predecessor in this position, and he worked, you know, his whole life. But at the end, the insect won. It did. The insect won.
Riley says it's nothing personal. He loves weevils. But for the sake of the peas, he can't let them win. Grant Blankenship, GPB News.
You'll find that story and some beautiful photos of cowpeas and weevils at gpb.org/news. Atlanta's West End neighborhood is easy to access. What is not so easy for residents to reach is fresh food. But that may be changing. A couple years ago, a small farmer's market featuring locally grown produce began at the nearby MARTA station. GPB's Sean Powers took his reusable tote bag and stopped by to bring us this audio postcard.
Give me some good peaches.
What is it, $2? Mm-hmm. All right, let me get my money out.
My name is Lee Cousins. You can call me Cousin Lee. I'm getting some peaches. I want some of them peaches.
$2
Yeah, give me $1 worth. I ain't got no teeth. I gotta have the soft ones. And all of this is good for me. I'm a diabetic. I got high blood pressure. All of this I need it. I'll be here every time they come. You gotta excuse me right now, eating.
My name is Lisa Shears.
Hi, my name is Frederica Dennis. She's my mother.
Even if you go into grocery stores, sometimes they don't have what you want. And at least, like here, we can just come to the train station and get it and then get on the train and go home.
Traveling on the bus is really hard. There are long distances. And also carrying the bags for a long distance is it's pretty taxing on the body as well.
My name is Cicely Garrett. I work at the Atlanta Community Food Bank. We sort of suspected that, you know, we have a natural built-in audience of people getting on and off the train. And so we thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice to see if people would just sort of stop on their way, like if they were going home or to and fro, and then they could also be introduced to some of the local growers to know what grows right here in the West End, as well as some other fruits and vegetables from around the state.
Those cucumbers, the cucumbers was grown in my friend's garden. Look here, you don't have to wear jeans to be a farmer. My name is Haleen Green, the garden queen. We grow our stuff right here. We're urban farmers. We are alleviating poverty through sustainability. I grow Jamaica's hibiscus, sorrel, and ginger in the West End, 1285 Ralph Abernathy Boulevard. Who would have known that you could grow Jamaica's sorrel and ginger in the West End? Ain't that something?
My name is Tracy Taylor. I'm a prep chef. I prep for her.
My name is Yemenya Muhammad.
I have a tattoo that says chef right here on my chest. Can you see it? Can you see it?
She's my prep, not a chef. But anyway, yeah. This is a wonderful experience. And what really makes this important to me as a chef is as a black woman living in Atlanta, it took this long for something like this to come in this community. It's unfortunate, but it's good because it's finally here.
My name is
Frida Hodiah Truesdell. I think it's a cute idea. Anytime there's fresh, nutritious food around, that's always a good idea for a community. I'm talking all of this nutritious stuff, and look what I got, a homemade brownie with, I know it's got a lot of sugar in it and all of that, and I'm going to be sorry I ate it. But because I stay on health kick majority of my life, I think I'll do all right.
Sounds from the farmer's market at the West End MARTA station in Atlanta. The market opens up again this spring. Just ahead, should Georgia rebrand itself as the Blueberry State? This is On Second Thought.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I found you, the moon stood still.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. This is a special hour. It's focused on what grows in Georgia, and it's the kickoff to our series, Georgia Eats, a year-long look at food in the Peach State. That is still our state nickname, but you might argue it should be the Blueberry State. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says peaches have taken second place to blueberries as the state's number one fruit crop. In 2015, Georgia knocked Michigan out of first place with 96 million pounds of blueberries. That's according to the North American Blueberry Council. Kerry Tomlinson joined us. He owns a blueberry farm in Clinch County. And I spoke with Joe Cornelius. He's the chair of the Georgia Blueberry Commission. Joe joined me from his farm in Ware County. And I began by asking him what makes Georgia a good place to grow blueberries.
One of the things is our production windows fit into a good marketplace. The other is we have a lot of good soils for the varieties we grow.
What does that mean? What kind of soil do you need to grow a blueberry?
Acidic with a fair amount of organic matter and access to water.
And Kerry, you came into blueberries relatively recently. What made you decide to get into the blueberry business?
Always had a little bit of a farming background, and then I live on a farm. And growing blueberries, because it is a fruit and then food group that is in the most categories in the top as far as nutrition. But it's something that you can do more on a smaller scale than big row crop farming.
When you say small scale, how many blueberries do you grow?
Acreage-wise, I only have 20 acres, which, at the time, was a fair amount. Now, they're up, in bigger sizes.
And Joe, how many acres of blueberries do you grow?
We've got about 170.
Holy cow. And what is the growing season for a blueberry?
The harvest season actually can start mid-April and run through July. Or run into July pretty well.
But Kerry, what's the best time of year to get the most delicious? If I'm shopping at my grocery store, what's the peak season?
Well, the peak season for the southern high bush through this area, is right through around the 1st of May, because that's when it's really coming into production.
And then your house is filled with the smell of blueberry jam and blueberry pie?
Well, not as far as the jam and the pies, but we have blueberries everywhere.
Yeah. And Joe, do you still eat a lot of blueberries? Are you darn sick of them?
No, you just get started eating and it's one right after the other.
And you can't stop.
Right.
Well, there's worse things to become addicted to. I mean, Joe, I wonder, do most of those blueberries stay here in Georgia? Where do your blueberries go?
They actually go worldwide. I'd say probably 70 to 80% stay in North America and Canada. The 20% or so is exported around the world.
So I wonder, Kerry, is this a fad? Is blueberry kind of a trendy fruit right now, or is this something that will remain relatively strong, do you think?
No, I think this is something that's going to be here for a while, simply because from the people being aware, of health and blueberries being such a nutritional product.
And yet, Joe, the state is known as the peach crop. Would you want to see it changed to the blueberry state?
We're friends with them boys in the peach industry, so,
They're listening, Joe. Don't say anything negative.
That's the reason We're just glad that the world is starting to recognize Georgia as a blueberry producing state.
Is it? Is it an easy crop to make money at?
It gets to be in according to the marketplace.
Just like with any other type of farming, you're dealing with markets. You're dealing with weather and nature, and so it's a gamble. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's not very good, depending on how. Just like last night, what Joe and I and all other farmers have been running into, and will be until the cold is away, is hoping that we can save these blooms to where they can come on in and make fruit.
And so, is this year expected to be a bumper crop?
So far, the weather has kind of cooperated. I believe it is.
Mm-hmm. Everything's lining up to be a good crop, is according to what happens in the next 45 to 60 days with Mother Nature.
And a lot can happen.
All right. Well, I guess I'll be heading into the grocery store somewhere around the beginning of May to see what did happen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have to maybe stop on the way to Augusta to pick up some blueberry pie. Speaking of Joe Cornelius, he's the chair of the Georgia Blueberry Commission and also blueberry farmer Kerry Tomlinson. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much, Celeste.
Now, if you drive south on I-75, about 90 minutes from Macon, you'll find the town of Tifton, Georgia, population 16,000 or so. They call themselves the Friendly City. But Tifton could be known as the Foodie City soon. A couple years ago, it was named the best place to open a restaurant in Georgia by Restaurant Business Magazine. David Scarborough would probably agree with that. He's the owner and chef of the local kitchen and bar in Tifton. I started off by asking him what comes to mind when you say Tifton could be a foodie city.
Well, there's certainly a lack of privately owned, handmade, if you will, restaurants where, you know, the food is actually made from scratch. There are a few local restaurants here that do that sort of thing. But, you know, we've kind of been swallowed up by chains and fast food. So I think there's a certain group of people, or, you know, maybe even a larger demographic of those folks who are looking for real food that's fresh, that's made by someone who cares.
Okay, that's a pretty diplomatic answer. But can I ask you why you think that Tifton has been named the best? And in this case, they're talking about revenue. The place, restaurants are very difficult to make a profit at. So,
yeah.
What makes Tifton a good place to open a restaurant?
Well, we're right here in the middle of everything. It's I-75, US 82. They're right next to each other. Or they intersect right here. There's a lot of business in the area of those restaurants. Of that intersection. There are a lot of restaurants there, but, you know, it's mostly chains. So I think you have a huge corridor here where people are moving, trying to get into Florida, out of Florida, up 95. It's just a great place to. There's just so much going on here. There are a lot of people passing through here. You know, Tifton is just a really agricultural rich area. A lot of farmers, a lot of agritourism, and it's kind of this melting pot of travelers, if you will. I mean, there's just a lot of movement here, and you got a lot of people who are staying here over the night, who are here for business for the week, and driving agrotourism, which is really kind of coming of age here right now.
Well, since you mentioned agrotourism, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. My guest is David Scarborough. He's the owner and chef of the local kitchen and bar in Tifton. But one thing people may come to Tifton for is a new commodity in the food industry in the United States, at least, homegrown truffles, pecan truffles, because they grow on pecan trees. And joining us now is Tim Brenneman. He's a professor in plant pathology at the University of Georgia's Tifton campus. He discovered the pecan truffle in the area. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Listen, before we get started on pecan truffles and how differently they taste, and David explains to us how you use them, can we just settle the whole thing of pronunciation of pecan? Because every time we talk about pecans, I get complaints because I say pecan instead of pecan. Pecan? How do you say it, Tim?
I generally say pecan, but I work with growers all over the state, and I hear the growers themselves refer to it in different ways, so you're in good company.
Okay. Yeah. David, how do you say it?
Probably the worst, the pecan.
Pecan. Okay. And you're from Tifton.
I am.
Okay.
I am, and I love them, too.
Okay. So, Tim, explain to me what a pecan truffle is.
Truffle is a fungus that grows underground on the roots of the pecan tree. And it's a mycorrhizal fungus. It's beneficial, so it actually helps the tree grow better. And it's sort of like when you see mushrooms in your yard, they're fungi that are reproducing. And this is the way that the truffle reproduces, except that it forms this really distinct, very firm underground fruiting body. And so it is underground, so you don't see it unless you're out there digging around.
And how does it... David, have you tasted these pecan truffles?
I have. They're a little milder than... Well, I would say they're a lot milder than a regular white truffle. But they have this nuttiness, and it's a distinct, earthy, typical of a mushroom or a truffle. They're delicious. I've had them at Elizabeth's on 37th over in Savannah. So I know that they make their way around... a little bit here in the South.
And are they a similar taste? Can you use them in the same way that you use one of, say, an Italian truffle?
Sure. I mean, you know, the applications are basically the same. Your results are not necessarily as pronounced as, you know, you may find with, you know, the Italian truffles, but they certainly are a treasure for chefs. You know, around here and in the area, whatnot, who know about them.
So, Tim, I mean, one of the things that we think we know about truffles is that you can't really grow them like a crop. Did you guys try to make them grow among pecan trees' roots? Did you try, fostering them?
Yes, actually, we have actually done it. We inoculated
you successfully
some trees
grew them
about 11 years ago, and it took 11 years from the time we did the inoculations until we got the first truffles.
Wow.
So it's not a simple, easy thing to do. If it was, I'm sure it would be being done all the time. But we do have a lot of ongoing efforts to try to find out how to do it better.
And Tim, you're on the lookout for these. Do they only grow with pecan trees?
Actually, they have been found with other species as well, but there's a lot of work going on with the taxonomy of these organisms.
Yeah.
So I think it's very much in a state of flux, and I think that this, what is now being called one species, will probably end up being separated out, and at that point it may be more of a unique association with pecans, but that's still to be determined.
So, David, I mean, I wonder what this means for you. If Tifton or that area could be a place where these particular kind of truffles grow really well, can that be what you were talking about earlier in terms of agrotourism?
Absolutely. I think you find a way to consistently, safely, and without losing any integrity of the actual product itself. I think if you were to find a way to really be able to harvest truffles in a intended, you know, with intent, that would certainly you know, people would love that. I mean, it's such a, you know, and in the area, you know, the people more indigenous to this area may not be as familiar with them, but people out there, there are people out there who are foodies who know the value of a truffle, and they were, if you were to have truffles driving the economy the way pecans, peanuts, tobacco, or whatnot does around here, holy cow, it'd be something else.
Yeah. Well, since you talked about the value of a truffle, Tim, any idea what these pecan truffles go for?
The ones that I know that they're, and it's really just a cottage industry at this point. There's a number of individuals who harvest them either in their own orchard, or a few people now have dogs, and so they are finding
trained
them
to
more.
Find them.
And I think the going price is about $20 an ounce, which would be what, a little over $300 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah. that's a lot.
Which is up a little bit. I remember it seemed a few years back they were in the 150 to 225 kind of range. And, you know, that could be a few years farther back than I'm willing to admit, but probably, you know, closer to 8 to 10 years ago when I was actually living in Savannah. So, you know, it's interesting to see how these things, how they grow and just how they could get out into people's hands. It would be interesting to see how
well,
that could
let's-
happen.
David, let's bring it back to Tifton becoming a great place to open a restaurant and your discussion about local foods and all the different produce that you have there
right.
at your disposal. I mean, is there a particular kind of food that's really easy to get a hold of as a chef? And is there certain kinds of foods that is still really difficult?
Well, you know, being here in Tifton, you obviously, you know, like we said, we have a lot of farms that are growing a lot of vegetables. And you got more farmers, you got smaller farms, more independent type cottage industry type farms who are doing things on smaller scales, who are, you know, doing things without chemicals and fertilizers and you know, kind of going that organic natural route. And they get, you know, there are a couple of them who are sort of mad scientist kind of guys that, you know, they like to experiment with a lot of stuff. There's a guy named Tony Bozeman over in Sylvester who hadn't seen in a couple of weeks, but he's always got something interesting, whether it's a baby Swiss chard or he's got some patty pan squash. So we like seeing different little things. But, you know, around here we don't want to get too crazy yet. But vegetables are always really good. We're starting to get really nice protein. We're getting beef from Bluffton, Georgia,
and
white oak pastures.
I have to stop you here. David, you claim to have the best burger in the state? You're laughing,
yeah,
but you claim.
I tell you what, man, I'm a burger nut, and I'll put it up there. I'm right there behind it.
We might have to host a burger showdown here on the show.
Yeah, it is a delicious burger, and, you know, yeah, I would love to do a burger showdown. I haven't had a chance to speak with any of my chef buddies in the past few days about that, but we're certainly I'm gonna throw something at them and we'll toss it around. Yeah, and I think that would be a lot of fun. You know, the burger has become, I think, sort of that's the, you know, the typical chef food. You know, if you ask a chef, you know, what are you wanting right now? Burger. Give me a good burger. You know, especially when we get off work. You know.
That's David Scarborough. He's the owner and chef of the local kitchen and bar in Tifton. And that's our show for today, but we know how passionate you all are about food, so make sure you give us your story ideas for our Year in Georgia edibles. The series is called Georgia Eats, and we want you to speak up, maybe without your mouthful. Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.